Everyone, I'm so glad that you're here today to hear a message on the awesome power of grit in your relationships. This is such a needed message. I've already heard it once, and it is outstanding and so apropos on this first Sunday of the year. Our speaker today is Dr. Michael Smalley. Michael is the president of the Smalley Institute, and their aim, their goal, pure and simple, is to help us build better relationships. Now, Mike carries on the legacy of his father, Dr. Gary Smalley, who wrote 60 books, sold over 12 million videos worldwide, helping families get better and stronger. I know one of the books that I treasured as a young father was Gary Smalley's book called The Blessing, How to Pass Along the Blessing to Your Children. Well, Mike Smalley and his wife, Amy, they have three children. They are strong Christians with a nationwide, yet even a worldwide ministry. And we're delighted to have Mike Smalley with us today and to speak here in this service on the awesome power of grit in your relationships. Would you please join me in welcome Dr. Michael Smalley to First Colony. Thank you, Mike.
Buenos dias. I gotta tell you, the sound system in this room makes you feel super powerful. So I have to bring it today. How are we? I forgot it was the first Sunday of the new year. That's uncomfortable. So it seems like the new year just happened. And it is really an honor to be here. You guys are awesome. The first a cappella service was amazing. And then I got to do the big class. That was super cool. Any of you in here did the big class? All right. Those of you who didn't go to the big class, shame on you for the new year. I'm kidding. It's okay. It's not okay. So, okay. Yes, my father was Gary Smalley, and I, under no circumstances, wanted to follow in his footsteps. That was not a part of my plan. I was going to be a journalist and a photographer. You know, my dream job would have been with National Geographic, something like that. And then the end of my junior year, the Lord was like, yeah, all that stuff you've studied, you're not going to do that. And so he called me into this ministry to help people build a better relationship. So I ended up following in his footsteps. And my father passed away, in case you don't know, in March of 2016. So he lived with my wife and I the last year and a half of his life. We did home hospice, and that was an entire adventure unto itself. And it was a real blessing to be able to honor him in that way. And it tells you a lot about his legacy, that his kids were willing to take care of him to the bitter end. And so I share that because it's uncomfortable having a famous father. And a lot of times, since he passed or graduated to heaven, people don't know that. So I'm just trying to be loving on this new year, that if you came up to me after service and asked me how my dad was doing, we're preventing an uncomfortable conversation. Right? So you know, some of you are going to come up and go, oh, I love it. What's he up to? And I'd be like, well, he's dead. So just know my family's coping mechanism is sarcasm and dark, inappropriate humor. So having your father in home hospice gave me a deep well of inappropriate things to say. So I apologize ahead of time, Ronnie. I told you I was going to try not to mess this one up, but it's already started differently. So you might hear the awesome power of grit in your relationships, and you're thinking, really? We're going to talk about grit? Yes, yes, we are. And the key passage we're going to focus on this morning that I want to unpack for you is Matthew 26, 36 through 46. So if you have your Bible app, as I do, or your actual Bible, then you can go to Matthew 26. I'm going to start in 36. This is the New Living Translation. And it's sort of this really key, and it's why I chose it in talking about grit, because grit is the awesome power of passion and perseverance. That's really what grit is. And you're going to get an idea, because relationships are difficult and they don't always go according to plan. So in Matthew 26, it starts here. Then Jesus went with them to the olive grove called Gethsemane. And he said, sit here while I go over there to pray. He took Peter and Zebedee's two sons, James and John, and he became anguished and distressed. He told them, my soul is crushed with grief to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me. So do you understand what's happening? Jesus knows what's around the corner. This is the evening that it all begins, the suffering and the taking on of sin for each one of you and me included. So this is big. This is the biggest moment so far in his entire ministry, and the men that he has been traveling with, that he called his disciples, who were his closest best friends. He even took three of them out of the group of 12. So the super, super inside circle of friends, he needed them. He needed their support. He needed their encouragement. He asked them to pray for him because I am so distressed that I'm on the brink of death. So is this a stressful moment for him? I wonder how well his three best friends handled it. So he went on a little farther and bowed with his face to the ground, praying, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup of suffering be taken away from me. Yet I want your will done, not mine. Then, oh man, this gets nasty. Then he returned to the disciples and found them asleep. Have you ever been let down by someone you love deeply? Ever? His best, closest friends that he has poured out his life over the last 3 years are snoozing away when he did the right thing. Christ said, I am hurting. This is heavy. I need you. And they're like, we're with you. Might feel familiar in your own life. And then he said to Peter, the foundation of the church, he says to Peter, couldn't you watch with me even 1 hour? Keep watch and pray so that you will not give into temptation, for the spirit is willing, but the body is weak. Then Jesus left them a second time and prayed, my Father, if this cup cannot be taken away unless I drink it, your will be done. When he returned to them again, man, this is rough. He found them sleeping again, for they couldn't keep their eyes open. So he went to pray a third time. I mean, have you ever been to that place where you're so tired and maybe you're driving and it's too late at night? You know, has anyone here ever fallen asleep while you're driving? That's kind of what I imagine. You know, like, you know you can't go to sleep, but like, it's you can't help it. And you just, next thing you know, your eyes are, you're gone. They're exhausted. So he went to pray a third time, saying the same things. Then he came to the disciples and said, go ahead and sleep, have your rest, but look, the time has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Up, let's get going. Look, my betrayer is here. And who was that betrayer? Man, one of the close ones. If we can't see this for what it is, then what's the point? What was the last song we sang? He never gives up. What a beautiful, powerful snapshot of grit. That's really what Jesus is showing us and what Scripture is revealing to us in this short passage is grit. What is grit? Well, grit is firmness of character, indomitable spirit, and pluck. Have you ever heard the word pluck? I'd never read that until I read this definition. I'm like, pluck? I don't know if I want pluck. I like indomitable spirit, but pluck, I don't know. Apparently at the turn of the century, I actually got totally distracted and researched the word pluck, and it really wasn't worth it. Grit is about two things, and where the idea of the sermon came from is one of the best books I've ever read from a fellow psychologist person. Angela Duckworth wrote a book called Grit, The Awesome Power of Passion and Perseverance. The two key components of grit are passion and perseverance. Passion is an intense desire or enthusiasm for something, strong and barely controllable emotion. So grit isn't just the grinding out and the blah, and I guess it is. No, it's a passion to love that person no matter what. But grit is also perseverance. How does she define perseverance? Steadfastness in doing something. Here's the kicker for the new year. Steadfast in doing something despite difficulty or delay in achieving success. Some other words for perseverance are persistence, tenacity, determination, staying power, steadfastness, and purposefulness. Let me tell you, a guy who used to have a very severe speech impediment, that is a difficult string of sentences. Passion and perseverance. So when you look back at Matthew 26, 36 through 46, don't you see both of those things? I mean, here's the deal. Western culture, and I have the privilege of going all over the world, so I've been almost everywhere except Australia and New Zealand. So I've been to India, Africa, China, Europe, South America, Central America. I mean, I've traveled 40-something percent of the globe, okay? So I've been around the block. I've seen how other cultures do it. And the thing that stands out to me about you and I and the people in the United States of America is how wimpy we are when it comes to our relationships. Because somewhere down the road, because of our prosperity and the wealth of this country, we got lazy and we got spoiled. There is nothing like a good shaming, condemnation thing to start off the new year. I swear this is gonna get more positive in a second. I was like, man, you're really pouring it on thick. Right? But because of this prosperity, which is awesome, we've developed this idea that our relationships should be easy. And that if I'm not happy or satisfied, I need to quit and find someone else. But here's the dirty little secret. There is no one else. Because you can't find anybody that will be devoid of problems. The reason grit is so important for your relationship is that every single one of you, and I just take a second and look at each other, just look around at the people, you are surrounded by sick people. I mean, they are as dysfunctional as you are, and that's the best part because you think you're the only one that's dysfunctional, but every single person in this room this morning is impacted and infected with sin. So the reason grit is so important is that you might be in this relationship and it's difficult. And by the way, any relationship could be with a spouse, a child, a parent, a sibling, a boss, an employee, a coworker, a neighbor. It's any relationship of significance in your life. If this one's difficult and you break this one apart or you separate this one to go find a better one, guess what you're going to find over here? Another dysfunctional person, which means you will do one of two things will happen guaranteed. You will either replicate the dysfunction you had over there because you never did the work to get healing, or let's say you do the work to get healing and you end up here, you'll discover a whole new genre of dysfunction that you didn't even know existed until you met this person. The reason grit is so important for your relationship is because your relationship is difficult. It is not perfect. These men and disciples were with Christ. They saw the miracles. People, they saw them firsthand. And in the time of Jesus' greatest needs, they can't meet them. And they fall and they fail miserably to do for Jesus what he deserved to have done. So grit is important because people are not going to love you the way you deserve. You deserve to be treated well. You do. But it doesn't always happen, so then what? And my fear for people is that you buy into this lie that my relationship should be ultimately awesome all the time, and if it's not, I got to find another one. My belief is that it's the hard times that make my marriage beautiful. It's coming out of the valley, hanging on by a thread, that I can eventually climb and reach the mountaintop. You can't get to the mountaintop without a difficult journey. I mean, anybody here live in a two-story home? All right. So, ma'am, when you make the journey to go from that first floor to that second floor, do you take like a selfie and maybe a panoramic of the view of the house from the, because you're like so elated with joy when you make it to the second floor of your house? You don't? That's weird. Seems semi-unappreciative of your two-story dwelling. Now, just out of curiosity, if you went on a adventure to Africa and climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, which will probably take you 5 days of tough hiking and then however many feet up, would you celebrate? Might there be a scream or a dance? Are you going to take a lot of photos? Well, that's weird, because that the one to the top of Kilimanjaro was significantly more difficult than the second floor of your home, right? I mean, it was hard. It was sweaty, and there's bugs biting you, and it's exhausting going and climbing an altitude. And yet, that's the one you enjoy significantly more than the easy one, right? Huh. I wonder why that is. How come we can't get that same concept in your relationship? You guys keep perceiving the difficult times in your relationship as ultimately bad. What I'm trying to tell you this morning is maybe, just maybe, the hard thing you're going through now is part of the journey to the mountaintop. And that when you get there, and you eventually will, because all of us die. Thank you for getting that over here. You'll eventually get there. It makes the mountaintop significantly more enjoyable because of the difficulty in the journey. So maybe this morning you can stop looking at the problems of your spouse or of your children or of your parents or of your siblings or of your neighbors or of your church. I mean, I've gotten to know Ronnie a little bit, and I am sorry that you deal with this guy. And he is just mean to the core. I mean, very kind. I'm sorry, but maybe you need to stop looking at those things as bad and start recognizing them for what they really are. That is a part of the beautiful journey. And the harder it is, the greater it will feel when you get to that mountaintop. But too many of us quit the mountaintop. And you might be looking at me going, yeah, that's real easy for you to say. You had Gary Smalley as a father, and you know, I have my PhD in marriage and family. My wife has her master's in marriage and family. We do this for a living. We're experts in relationships, and you're like, easy for you to say, I married a horrible person. That's what he said earlier. Oh, I'm sorry. I said I wouldn't share that. Okay, but guess what? I'm in the same stinking boat you guys are. I mean, I had the love story of love stories, much like the disciples who got to experience and see the miracles. They still failed Christ in the hour of his greatest need. My own love story is the I have two comedy routines and two books I've written on. It's extraordinary. I met her at Baylor University. This is like the super quick version. She was a sophomore and I was a freshman. She was trying out for cheerleader. I was like, well, hello there. Fell deeply in love with her, love at first sight, obsessed for 12 months on how I could get to know her, and eventually discovered and taught myself over the course of a year how to be a male cheerleader. So my big idea was, hey, if I make the squad, meet the girl, we'll fall in love, start dating, get married, and have babies. And so literally, I'd never had a single conversation with her. I met her at the end of my freshman year, taught myself how to be a cheerleader, and tried out the following year, and made the squad to meet the girl and get married. This was the big goal. Unfortunately, it was slightly impulsive and not the greatest of plans, because when I got on the squad, I found out she'd been dating a guy for 4 years. And then at the Baylor SMU game in Dallas, which he lived in Dallas, he took her out to dinner. I'm the first person she showed her engagement ring to. Yeah, that was painful. Because up until that moment, I was a male cheerleader to meet the girl and get married. Now I was just a male cheerleader. And so the more I got to know her, the more I fell in love with her. And 2 years later, she's engaged. She's about to get married. It's May. It's the end of my junior year. She's graduating. I'm never going to see her again. And I am so distraught because all my life, all I ever wanted to be was married. It's true. I know it's not a normal guy thing, but on career day in third grade, when all the little kids stand up and go, this is what I'm going to be, little Michael Thomas Smalley stood up at 9 years old and said, and Mrs. Cox said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I looked and went, I want to be a husband and a father. Which is probably a precursor to becoming a male cheerleader one day. And so I was on the sensitive side of the spectrum. And so all I'd ever wanted to be was married, and now I'm in love with a girl who's in love with another guy, and the more I get to know her, the more I fall in love with her because she's way more than just looks. She is beautiful. To this day, she's beautiful. I still stalk her to this day. And at the end of my junior, I'm so distraught, I start crying out just like Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, because that's how I was taught to pray. And I start praying over and over and over again because I am so upset and I'm so depressed and I'm in love with a girl who's in love with someone else that I keep going, Lord, you know who I want to marry, and it's not going real well, but I want your will done, not mine. And I did this over and over again until one morning the Lord really prompted me as if he was sitting next to me in my car and said, I want you to go say goodbye to Amy. And I genuinely went, oh, finally, the Lord is going to flush this chick out of my system, and I can move on with my life. So I go to her apartment to say goodbye forever. At this point, we're very close friends because, you know, six guys, six girls. And she answers the door. She was on the phone talking about ending her engagement when I came knocking. Does that feel like a coincidence? Yeah, it didn't to me either. I was like, what? I was like, you're the greatest. And then I was going to tell her how I felt because I thought this isn't a coincidence. And the Lord very clearly said, don't you dare do that. And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm literally hugging her, having a conversation with God. I mean, what do you mean? You brought me here. He goes, I know that, but you are not to declare your undying love because that would be creepy. And it'll backfire. And I'm like, oh, what am I allowed to say? And of course, the Lord's like, just ask her how you can help. I went, actually, that sounds like a good plan. So I just said, is there anything I can do to help? I'm so sorry. And she's sobbing. And if your father is on television every day and radio and a world famous marriage expert, what might the young lady ask? Oh, I don't know. I mean, would any of your dad's books help us? And I went, and then I was like, really? Seriously, I was like, okay, this is totally messed up. And the next thing you know, I'm driving the woman of my dreams to the mall to purchase my father's books to help her repair the relationship with the other guy. That didn't feel like a plan. My father's first conversation with his future daughter-in-law was counseling her on a conference call with the other guy. That's his first conversation with Amy. I was trying to help her with this other dude, which I don't use his real name. I've just always called him Satan. Felt like it fit. It's a good name. So you want to talk about miraculous. The Lord wouldn't let me anywhere near her but to help, and then my dad tried to help, but then lo and behold, it didn't work out, and she breaks up with him in June. She starts pursuing me, which was insane, in July. We start dating. We're engaged September 30th and then married December 17th, 2 weeks after she was supposed to marry the other guy. You're not as healthy as the first service. I mean, you were apprehensive, but you were still sort of celebratory, but hopefully you all realize how stupid that was, right? I mean, could there maybe have been an unresolved issue or two? I mean, seriously? We have the love story of love stories, and then 18 hours into my married life, my dream come true. No way. Siri keeps going off. I was saying something like that, I guess. Well, it's funny. Stop it, Siri. 18 hours into the dream of a lifetime with my dream girl, I'm not speaking to her. I'm totally shut down. Our honeymoon is so terrible. We were on a 7-day Southern Caribbean cruise. Our fighting was so out of control. She would scream and explode, and I would shut down. I spent the majority of the day hiding on the cruise ship away from her. It was so bad that we left early. I had to get permission from the captain to leave the ship early because we didn't want to be with each other anymore. And had I not been Gary Smalley's son and she not been a devoted follower, we would have annulled that thing, but we had gotten married in front of 350 people, and that was way too embarrassing, so we didn't annul it. But the first 6 months were so bad, and if you think I say this lightly, 3 months into my marriage, we get into this vicious, nasty, one of the top five hurts of my entire life. 3 months into the marriage, I go running out of this log cabin we're living in Branson, Missouri. I go running down the road. The only way I think I can get out of this disaster of a marriage is if I die. And so I laid out in the middle of the road for 3 hours waiting for a vehicle, which realistically could have been her. But think about that. How discouraged and depressed was I that I am suicidal? I am in the middle, laying in the dark, out in the middle of the road, hoping someone is driving by and won't see me and will kill me. Would you say that was pretty discouraged? This is why grit is so important, because you hit those spaces. Your spouse, your child, your parent, your sibling disappoints you to a level that you think you'll never get over. I remember as if it was, I get goosebumps. I laid there in that road and thought, I will never get over this. I will never be happy. This is it. And then 3 months later, miserable, holding on by the hair of my chin. I didn't have a beard then. I do now. You're welcome, ladies. 3 months later, 6 months into my marriage, I find myself at a professional conference for, I was actually in marriage and family grad school at the time. Miserable. 6 months, and I find myself at this thing where I've learned what I taught in the big class. I learn what's wrong. And at that point, I bought the book. I came home. I went, if you're willing, I think this can really help us. She's like, I'll do anything. And that's when it turned around. And then 10 years later, we hit another bump. We hit another one 5 years ago. My oldest child can't make a healthy decision in life. We all get disappointed. We all feel let down. We all get abandoned in our greatest hour of need. What gets you through it is passion, a belief that this is worth sticking to it, and then the perseverance to hang on, even when it is darkest, even when you're laying in the middle of a road, just hang on, because Christ promises that this horrible stuff that happens to you, I will redeem. And the question this morning at the beginning of the new year is, are you willing to wait and to be patient enough to allow God to work through you and through the person that's hurting you? Because sometimes all you can do is hang on, and that's okay. Because at some point, you'll get to the mountaintop. And then you'll look back on all of that stuff. I don't regret a single hurt that I've been through in life, because those hurts are what have made who I am today.